Chapter 32. Jerusalem. Shamron took Gabriel to Mount Herzl. It was beginning to get dark as he headed up the tree-lined walkway to the hospital's entrance. Leah's new doctor awaited him in the lobby. Rotund and bespectacled, he had the long beard of a rabbi and an unfailingly pleasant demeanor. He introduced himself as Mordecai Barzvi, then took Gabriel by the arm and led him along a corridor of cool Jerusalem limestone. By gesture and intonation, he made it clear to Gabriel that he knew much about the patient's rather unorthodox case history.
"I must say, it appears she came through it remarkably well."
"Is she talking?"
"A little."
"Does she know where she is?"
"Sometimes. I can say one thing for certain. She's very anxious to see you."
The doctor looked at Gabriel over the top of his smudged eyeglasses.
"You seem surprised."
"She went 13 years without speaking to me." The doctor shrugged.
"I doubt that will ever happen again."
They came to a door. The doctor knocked once and led Gabriel inside. Leah was seated in an armchair in the window. She turned as Gabriel entered the room and smiled briefly. He kissed her cheek, then sat on the edge of the bed. She regarded him silently for a moment, then turned and looked out the window again. It was as if he were no longer there. The doctor excused himself and closed the door as he left. Gabriel sat there with her, content to say nothing at all as the pine trees outside receded gently into the gathering darkness. He stayed for an hour, until a nurse entered the room and suggested it was time for Leah to get some sleep. When Gabriel stood, Leah's head swiveled round.
"Where are you going?"
"They say you need to rest."
"That's all I ever do."
Gabriel kissed her lips.
"One last..."
She stopped herself.
"You'll come see me again tomorrow?"
"And the next day." She turned away and looked out the window. There were no taxis to be had on Mount Herzl, so he boarded a bus crowded with evening commuters. The seats were all taken. He stood in the open space at the center and felt 40 pairs of eyes boring into him. On the Jaffa Road, he stepped off and waited in a shelter for an eastbound bus. Then he thought better of it. He had survived one ride. A second seemed an invitation to disaster. So he set off on foot through a swirling night wind. He paused for a moment at the entrance of the Makane Yehuda market, then headed for Narcus Street. Kiara must have heard his footfalls on the stairwell because she was waiting for him on the landing outside their apartment. Her beauty, after the scars of Leah, seemed even more shocking. Gabriel, when he bent to kiss her, was offered only a cheek. Her newly washed hair smelled of vanilla. She turned and went inside. Gabriel followed after her, then stopped suddenly. The apartment had been completely redecorated. New furniture, new carpets and fixtures, a fresh coat of paint. The table had been laid and candles lit. Their diminished length suggested they'd been burning for some time. Kiara, as she passed by the table, snuffed them out.
"It's beautiful," Gabriel said.
"I worked hard to finish it before you arrived. I wanted it to feel like a proper home. Where have you been?"
She tried, with little success, to ask the question without a confrontational tone.
"You can't be serious, Kiara. Your helicopter landed 3 hours ago, and I know you didn't go to King Saul Boulevard because Lev's office called here looking for you."
She paused.
"You went to see her, didn't you? You went to see Leah."
"Of course I did."
"It didn't occur to you to come to see me first?"
"She's in a hospital. She doesn't know where she is. She's confused. She's scared."
"I suppose Leah and I have a lot in common after all."
"Let's not do this, Kiara."
"Do what?"
He headed down the hallway to their bedroom. It, too, had been redecorated. On Gabriel's nightstand were the papers that, when signed, would dissolve his marriage to Leah. Kiara had left a pen beside them. He glanced up and saw her standing in the doorway. She was staring at him, searching his eyes for evidence of his emotions, like a detective, he thought, observing a person of interest at the scene of the crime.
"What happened to your face?"
Gabriel told her about the beating he'd been given.
"Did it hurt?"
She didn't seem terribly concerned.
"Only a little."
He sat on the edge of the bed and pulled off his shoes.
"How much did you know?" "Shamron told me right away that the hit had gone wrong. He kept me updated throughout the day. The moment I heard you were safe was the happiest moment in my life."
Gabriel took note of the fact that Kiara had not mentioned Leah.
"How is she?"
"Leah?" Kiara closed her eyes and nodded. Gabriel quoted the prognosis of Dr. Barsby. Leah had come through it remarkably well. He removed his shirt. Kiara covered her mouth. His bruises, after 3 days at sea, had turned deep purple and black.
"It looks worse than it really is," he said. "Have you seen a doctor?"
"Not yet."
"Take off your clothes. I'll run a hot bath for you. A good soak will do you good."
She left the room. A few seconds later, he heard water splashing against enamel. He undressed and went into the bathroom. Kiara examined his bruises again. Then she ran her hand through his hair and looked at the roots.
"It's long enough to cut now. I don't want to make love to a gray-haired man tonight."
"So, cut it." He sat on the edge of the bath. As always, Kiara sang to herself while she cut his hair, one of those silly Italian pop songs she loved so much. Gabriel, his head bowed, watched as the last silvered remnants of Herr Klemp fluttered to the floor. He thought of Cairo, and how he had been deceived, and the anger welled within him once more. Kiara switched off the shears.
"There! You look like yourself again. Black hair, gray at the temples. What was it Shamron used to say about your temples?"
"He called them smudges of ash," Gabriel said. "Smudges of ash on the Prince of Fire." Kiara tested the temperature of the bath. Gabriel unwrapped the towel from his waist and slid into the water. It was too hot. Kiara always made it too hot. But after a few moments, the pain began to retreat from his body. She sat with him for a time. She talked about the apartment and an evening she had spent with Gilles Shamron, anything but France. After a while, she went into the bedroom and undressed. She sang softly to herself. Kiara always sang when she removed her clothing. Her kisses, usually so tender, pained his lips. She made love to him feverishly, as though trying to draw Leah's venom from his bloodstream, and her fingertips left new bruises on his shoulders.
"I thought you were dead," she said. "I thought I'd never see you again."
"I was dead," Gabriel said. "I was dead for a very long time." The walls of their bedroom in Venice had been hung with paintings. Kiara, in Gabriel's absence, had hung them here. Some of the works had been painted by Gabriel's grandfather, the noted German expressionist Viktor Frankl. His work had been declared degenerate by the Nazis in 1936. Impoverished, stripped of his ability to paint or even teach, he had been deported to Auschwitz in 1942 and gassed on arrival along with his wife. Gabriel's mother, Irene, had been deported with them, but Mengele had assigned her to a work detail, and she'd managed to survive the women's camp at Birkenau until it was evacuated in the face of the Russian advance. Some of her work hung here in Gabriel's private gallery. Tormented by what she had seen in Birkenau, her paintings burned with an intensity unmatched by even her famous father. In Israel, she had used the name Alon, which means oak tree in Hebrew, but she'd always signed her canvases Frankl, to honor her father. Only now could Gabriel see the paintings for themselves, instead of the broken woman who had produced them. There was one work that bore no signature, a portrait of a young man in the style of Aegon Scheele. The artist was Leah, and the subject was Gabriel himself. It had been painted shortly after he returned to Israel with the blood of 6 Palestinian terrorists on his hands, and it was the only time he ever agreed to sit for her. He had never liked the painting, because it showed him as Leah saw him, a haunted young man, aged prematurely by the shadow of death. Chiara believed the painting to be a self-portrait. She switched on the bedroom light and looked at the papers on the bedside table. Her examination was demonstrative in nature. She knew that Gabriel had not signed them.
"I'll sign them in the morning," he said. She offered him the pen. "Sign them now."
Gabriel switched off the light.
"Actually, there's something else I want to do now."
Chiara took him into her body and wept silently through the act.
"You're never going to sign them, are you?"
Gabriel tried to silence her with a kiss.
"You're lying to me," she said. "You're using your body as a weapon of deception."
Chapter 33. Jerusalem. His days quickly acquired shape. In the mornings, he would wake early and sit in Chiara's newly decorated kitchen with coffee and the newspapers. The stories about the Khaled affair depressed him. Haaretz christened the affair Bunglegate, and the office lost its battle to keep Gabriel's name out of print. In Paris, the French press besieged the government and the Israeli ambassador for an explanation of the mysterious photographs that had appeared in Le Monde. The French foreign minister, a blow-dried former poet, threw gasoline on the fire by expressing his belief that there may indeed have been an Israeli hand in the Holocaust of the Gare de Lyon. The next day, Gabriel read with a heavy heart that a kosher pizzeria on the Rue de Rosier had been vandalized. Then a gang of French boys attacked a young girl as she walked home from school and carved a swastika into her cheek. Chiara usually awakened an hour after Gabriel. She read of the events in France with more alarm than sadness. Once a day, she phoned her mother in Venice to make sure her family was safe. At 8, Gabriel would leave Jerusalem and make the drive down the Bab el-Wad to King Saul Boulevard. The proceedings were held in the top-floor conference room, so Lev would not have far to walk when he wished to pop in and observe them. Gabriel, of course, was the star witness. His conduct, from the moment he'd returned to office discipline until his escape from the Gare de Lyon, was reviewed in excruciating detail. Despite Shamron's dire predictions, there was to be no bloodletting. The results of such investigations were usually preordained, and Gabriel could see from the outset that he was not going to be made the scapegoat. This was a collective mistake, the committee members seemed to be saying by the tone of their questions, a forgivable sin committed by an intelligence apparatus desperate to avoid another catastrophic loss of life. Still, at times, the questions became pointed. Did Gabriel have no suspicions about the motivations of Mahmoud Arwish? Or the loyalty of David Quinnell? Would things not have gone differently if he'd listened to his teammates in Marseille and turned back instead of going with the girl? At least then, Khaled's plan to destroy the credibility of the office would not have succeeded.
"You're right," Gabriel said, "and my wife would be dead, along with many more innocent people."
One by one, the others were brought before the committee as well. First Yossi and Ramona, then Yaakov, and lastly Dina, whose discoveries had fueled the investigation into Khaled in the first place. It pained Gabriel to see them in the dock. His career was over, but for the others, the Khaled affair, as it had become known, would leave a black mark on their records that would never be expunged. In the late afternoon, when the committee had adjourned, he would drive to Mount Herzl to spend time with Leah. Sometimes they would sit in her room, and sometimes, if there was still light, he would place her in a wheelchair and push her slowly round the grounds. She never failed to acknowledge his presence, and usually managed to speak a few words to him. Her hallucinatory journeys to Vienna became less apparent, though he was never certain precisely what she was thinking.
"Where is Donnie buried?" she asked once, as they sat beneath the canopy of a pine tree.
"The Mount of Olives."
"Will you take me there sometime?"
"If your doctor says it's all right."
Once, Kiara accompanied him to the hospital. As they entered, she sat down in the lobby and told Gabriel to take his time.
"Would you like to meet her?"
Kiara had never seen Leah.
"No," she said. "I think it's better if I wait here. Not for my sake. For hers."
"She won't know."
"She'll know, Gabriel. A woman always knows when a man's in love with someone else."
They never quarreled about Leah again. Their battle, from that point onward, was a black operation, a covert affair waged by long silences and remarks edged with double meaning. Kiara never entered their bed without first checking to see whether the papers had been signed. Her lovemaking was as confrontational as her silences.
"My body is intact," she seemed to be saying to him. "I'm real. Leah is only a memory."
The apartment grew claustrophobic, so they took to eating out. Some evenings they walked over to Ben Yehuda Street, or to Mona, a trendy restaurant that was actually located in the cellar of the old campus of the Bezalel Academy of Art. One evening they drove down Highway 1 to Abu Ghosh, one of the only Arab villages along the road to survive the expulsions of Plan Dalet. They ate hummus and grilled lamb in an outdoor restaurant in the village square, and for a few moments it was possible to imagine how different things might have been had Khaled's grandfather not turned the road into a killing zone. Kiara marked the occasion by buying Gabriel an expensive bracelet from a village silversmith. The next evening, on King George Street, she bought him a silver watch to match. "Keepsakes," she called them, "tokens by which to remember me." When they returned home that night, there was a message on the answering machine. Gabriel pressed the playback button and heard the voice of Dina Sarid, telling him that she'd found someone who had been there the night Sumaria fell. The following afternoon, when the committee had adjourned, Gabriel drove to Schenken Street and collected Dina and Yakov from an outdoor cafe. They drove north along the coast highway through dusty pink light, past Herzliya and Netanya. A few miles behind Caesarea, the slopes of Mount Carmel rose before them. They rounded the Bay of Haifa and headed for Akko. Gabriel, as he continued north toward Nahariya, thought of Operation Ben Ami. The night a column of Haganah came up this very road with orders to demolish the Arab villages of the Western Galilee. Just then, he glimpsed a strange conical structure, stark and gleaming white, rising above the green blanket of an orange grove. The unusual building, Gabriel knew, was the Children's Memorial at Yad Leyaled, a museum of Holocaust remembrance at Kibbutz Lohame Hagatot. The settlement had been founded after the war by survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Adjacent to the edge of the kibbutz, and barely visible in the tall, wild grass, were the ruins of Sumeria. He turned onto a local road and followed it inland. Dusk was fast approaching as they entered Al-Makkah. Gabriel stopped on the main street and, with the engine still running, entered a coffee house and asked the proprietor for directions to the house of Hamza al-Samara. A moment of silence followed while the Arab appraised Gabriel coolly from the opposite side of the counter. Clearly he assumed the Jewish visitor to be a Shabak officer, an impression Gabriel made no effort to correct. The Arab led Gabriel back into the street and, with a series of points and gestures, showed him the way. The house was the largest in the village. It seemed several generations of al-Samaras lived there, because there were a number of small children playing in the small dusty courtyard. Seated in the center was an old man. He wore a gray galabia and white kafia and was puffing on a water pipe. Gabriel and Yaakov stood at the open side of the courtyard and waited for permission to enter. Dina remained in the car. The old man, Gabriel knew, would never speak forthrightly in the presence of a bare-headed Jewess. Al-Samara looked up and with a desultory wave of his hand, beckoned them. He spoke a few words to the oldest of the children, and a moment later two more chairs appeared. Then a woman came, a daughter perhaps, and brought three glasses of tea. All this before Gabriel had even explained to him the purpose of his visit. They sat in silence for a moment, sipping their tea and listening to the buzz of cicadas in the surrounding fields. A goat trotted into the courtyard and gently butted Gabriel's ankle. A child, robed and barefoot, shooed the animal away. Time, it seemed, had stopped. Were it not for the electric lights coming on in the house and the satellite dish atop the roof, Gabriel would have found it easy to imagine that Palestine was still ruled from Constantinople.
"Have I done something wrong?" the old man asked in Arabic.
It was the first assumption of many Arabs when two tough-looking men from the government arrived uninvited at their door.
"No," Gabriel said. "We just wanted to talk to you."
"About what?"
The old man, hearing Gabriel's answer, drew thoughtfully on his water pipe. He had hypnotic gray eyes and a neat mustache. His sandaled feet looked as though they had never seen a pumice stone.
"Where are you from?" he asked.
"The valley of Jezreel," Gabriel replied.
Al-Samarra nodded slowly.
"And before that?"
"My parents came from Germany."
The gray eyes moved from Gabriel to Yaakov.
"And you?" "Hedera."
"And before?"
"Russia." "Germans and Russians,"
Al-Samarra said, shaking his hand.
"Were it not for Germans and Russians, I'd still be living in Sumeria, instead of here in Al-Makar."
"You were there the night the village fell?"
"Not exactly. I was walking in a field near the village,"
he paused and added conspiratorially,
"with a girl."
"And when the raid started?"
"We hid in the fields and watched our families walking to the north toward Lebanon. We saw the Jewish sappers dynamiting our homes. We stayed in the field all the next day. When the darkness came again, we walked here to Al-Makar. The rest of my family, my mother and father, my brothers and sisters, all ended up in Lebanon."
"And the girl you were with that night?"
"She became my wife."
Another puff on the water pipe.
"I'm an exile too, an internal exile. I still have the deed to my father's land in Sumeria, but I cannot go back to it. The Jews confiscated it and never bothered to compensate me for my loss." "Imagine, a kibbutz built by Holocaust survivors on the ruins of an Arab village."
Gabriel looked around at the large house.
"You've done well for yourself."
"I'm far better off than those who went into exile. It could have been like this for all of us, if there had never been a war. I don't blame you for my loss. I blame the Arab leaders. If Haj Amin and the others had accepted the partition, the Western Galilee would have been part of Palestine. But they chose war. And when they lost the war, they cried that the Arabs had been victims. Arafat did the same thing at Camp David, yes? He walked away from another opportunity at partition. He started another war. And when the Jews fought back, he cried that he was the victim. When will we learn?"
The goat came back. This time Al-Samarra gave it a whack on the nose with the mouthpiece of his water pipe.
"Surely you didn't come all the way here to listen to an old man's story."
"I'm looking for a family that came from your village, but I don't know their name."
"We all knew each other," Al-Samarra said. "If we were to walk through the ruins of Samaria right now, I could show you my house, and I could show you the house of my friend and the houses of my cousins. Tell me something about this family, and I'll tell you their name."
He told the old man the things the girl had said during the final miles before Paris. That her grandfather had been a village elder, not a mukhtar but an important man, and that he'd owned 40 dunams of land and a large flock of goats. He'd had at least one son. After the fall of Sumeria, they'd gone north to Ain el-Hilwe in Lebanon. Al-Samarra listened thoughtfully to Gabriel's description,
but seemed perplexed. He called over his shoulder into the house. A woman emerged, elderly like him, her head covered by a veil. She spoke directly to Al-Samarra, carefully avoiding the gaze of Gabriel and Yaakov.
"You're sure it was 40 dunams? He asked. "Not 30 or 20, but 40?
"That's what I was told." He made a contemplative draw on his pipe.
"You're right," he said. "That family ended up in Lebanon, in Ain al-Hilweh. Things got bad during the Lebanese Civil War. The boys became fighters. They're all dead, from what I hear."
"Do you know their name?"
"They're called Al-Tamari. If you meet any of them, please give them my regards. Tell them I've been to their house. Don't tell them about my villa in Al-Makardo. It will only break their hearts."
Chapter 34. Tel Aviv.
"Ain el-Helwa? Are you out of your fucking mind?"
It was early the following morning. Lev was seated at his empty glass desk, his coffee cup suspended midway between his saucer and his lips. Gabriel had managed to slip into the office while Lev's secretary was in the ladies' room. The girl would pay dearly for the lapse in security when Gabriel was gone.
"Ain el-Hilwa is a no-go zone, period. End of discussion. It's worse now than it was in 82. A half dozen Islamic terror organizations have set up shop there. It's not a place for the faint of heart. Or an office agent whose picture has been splashed about the French press."
"Well, someone has to go."
"You're not even sure the old man's still alive."
Gabriel frowned, then sat uninvited in one of the sleek leather chairs in front of Lev's desk.
"But if he is alive, he can tell us where his daughter went after she left the camp."
"He might," Lev agreed, "or he might know nothing at all. Khaled certainly told the girl to deceive her family for security reasons. For all we really know, the entire story about Sumaria might be a lie."
"She had no reason to lie to me," Gabriel said. "She thought I was going to be killed."
Lev spent a long moment pondering his coffee.
"There's a man in Beirut who might be able to help us with this. His name is Nabil Azouri."
"What's his story?"
"He's Lebanese and Palestinian. He does a little of everything. Works as a stringer for a few Western news outlets. Owns a nightclub. Does the odd bit of arms dealing and has been known to move the odd shipment of hashish now and again. He also works for us, of course."
"Sounds like a real pillar of his community."
"He's a shit," Lev said. "Lebanese to the core. Lebanon incarnate. But he's exactly the kind of person we need to walk into Ain el-Hilweh and talk to the girl's father."
"Why does he work for us?"
"For money, of course. Nabil likes money."
"How do we talk to him?"
"We leave a message on the phone at his nightclub in Beirut, and an airline ticket with the concierge of the Commodore Hotel. We rarely talk to Nabil on his turf."
"Where does he go?"
"Cyprus," Lev said. "Nabil likes Cyprus, too."
It would be 3 days before Gabriel was ready to move. Travel saw to his arrangements. Larnaca is a popular Israeli tourist designation, and so it was not necessary to travel on a forged foreign passport. Traveling under his real name was not possible, though, so travel issued him an Israeli document under the rather unexceptional name of Michael Neumann. The day before his departure, operations let him spend an hour perusing Nabil Azouri's file in a secure reading room. When he had finished, they gave him an envelope with $10,000 in cash and wished him luck. The next morning, at 7, he boarded an El Al plane at Ben-Gurion Airport for the one-hour flight to Cyprus. Upon arriving, he rented a car at the airport and drove a short distance up the coast to a resort called the Palm Beach Hotel. A message from King Saul Boulevard awaited him. Nabil Azouri was coming that afternoon. Gabriel spent the remainder of the morning in his room. Then a short time after 1 o'clock, he went down to the poolside restaurant for lunch. Azouri already had a table. A bottle of expensive French champagne, drunk below the label, lay chilling in a silver bucket. He had dark,
curly hair, frosted with the first strands of gray, and a thick mustache. When he removed his sunglasses, Gabriel found himself gazing into a pair of large, sleepy brown eyes. On his left wrist was the obligatory gold watch. On his right, several gold bracelets that chimed when he lifted his champagne glass to his lips. His cotton shirt was cream-colored, his poplin trousers wrinkled from the flight from Beirut. He lit an American cigarette with a gold lighter and listened to Gabriel's proposition.
Ein El-Hilwe, are you out of your fucking mind?
Gabriel had anticipated this reaction. Azuri treated his relationship with Israeli intelligence as though it were just another one of his business enterprises. He was the bazaar merchant. The office was the customer. Haggling over the price was part of the process. The Lebanese leaned forward and fixed Gabriel in his sleepy stare.
Have you been down there lately? It's like the Wild West, Khomeini style. It's gone to hell since you boys pulled out. Men in black, praise be to Allah the Most Merciful. Outsiders don't stand a chance. Fuck it, Mike. Have some champagne and forget about it.
You're not an outsider, Nabil. You know everyone. You can go everywhere. That's why we pay you so lucratively.
Tip money, Mike. That's all I get from your outfit. Cigarettes and champagne and a few bucks to waste on the girls.
You must have expensive taste in girls, Nabil, because I've seen your pay stubs. You've made a rather large sum of money from your relationship with my firm. Azuri raised his glass in Gabriel's direction.
We've made good business together, Mike. I won't deny that. I'd like to continue working for you. That's why someone else needs to run down to Ein El-Hilwe for you. It's too rich for my blood. Too dangerous.
Azuri signaled the waiter and ordered another bottle of the French champagne. Refusing an offer of work wasn't going to keep him from having a good meal on the office tab. Gabriel tossed an envelope onto the table. Azuri eyed it thoughtfully, but made no move for it.
How much is in there, Mike?
2,000.
What flavor?
Dollars.
So what's the deal? Half now, half on delivery? I'm just a dumb Arab, but 2,000 and 2,000 add up to 4,000, and I'm not going into Ein El-Hilwe for $4,000.
2,000 is only the retainer.
And how much for delivery of the information?
Another 5. Azuri shook his head.
No, another 10.
6. Another shake of the head.
9.
7.
8.
Done, said Gabriel. 2,000 in advance, another 8 on delivery. Not bad for an afternoon's work. If you behave yourself, we'll even throw in gas money.
Oh, you'll pay for the gas, Mike. My expenses are always separate from my fee.
The waiter brought the second bottle of champagne. When he was gone again, Azuri said,
So, what do you want to know?
I want you to find someone.
There are 45,000 refugees in that camp, Mike. Help me out a little bit.
He's an old man named Al-Tamari.
First name?
We don't know it. Azuri sipped his wine.
It's not a terribly common name. It shouldn't be a problem. What else can you tell me about him?
He's a refugee from the Western Galilee.
Most of them are. Which village?
Gabriel told him.
Family details?
2 sons were killed in 82.
In the camp?
Gabriel nodded. They were Fatah. Apparently his wife was killed too.
Lovely. Go on.
He had a daughter. She ended up in Europe. I want to know everything you can find out about her. Where she went to school, what she studied, where she lived, who she slept with.
What's the girl's name?
I don't know.
Age?
Early 30s, I'd say. Spoke decent French.
Why are you looking for her?
We think she may have been involved in the attack on the Gare de Lyon.
Is she still alive?
Gabriel shook his head. Azuri looked out at the beach for a long moment.
So, you think that by tracing the background of the girl, you're going to get to the big boss, the brains behind the operation?
Something like that, Nabil.
How do I play it with the old man?
Play it any way you want to, Gabriel said. Just get me what I need.
This girl,
the Lebanese said.
What did she look like?
Gabriel handed Azuri a magazine he'd brought down from his room. Azuri opened it and leafed through the pages until he came upon the sketch Gabriel had made aboard Fidelity.
She looked like that, Gabriel said. She looked exactly like that.
He heard nothing from Nabil Azuri for 3 days. For all Gabriel knew, the Lebanese had absconded with the down payment, or had been killed trying to get into Ain El Hilweh. Then on the fourth morning, the telephone rang. It was Azuri calling from Beirut. He would be at the Palm Beach Hotel in time for lunch. Gabriel hung up the phone. Then he went down to the beach and took a long run at the water's edge. His bruises were beginning to fade, and much of the soreness had left his body. When he had finished, he returned to his room to shower and change. By the time he arrived at the poolside restaurant, Azuri was working on his second glass of champagne.
What a fucking place, Mike! Hell on earth!
I'm not paying you $10,000 for a report on conditions at Ain Al Hilweh, Gabriel said. That's the UN's job. Did you find the old man? Is he still alive?
I found him.
And?
The girl left Ain Al Hilweh in 1990. She's never been back.
Her name?
Fella, said Azuri. Fella Al-Tamari.
Where did she go?
She was a smart girl, apparently. Earned a UN grant to study in Europe. The old man told her to take it and never come back to Lebanon.
Where did she study? Gabriel asked, though he suspected he already knew the answer.
France, Azuri said. Paris first. Then she went somewhere in the south. The old man wasn't sure. Apparently there were long periods with no contact.
I'm sure there were.
He didn't seem to fault his daughter. He wanted a better life for her in Europe. He didn't want her wallowing in the Palestinian tragedy, as he put it to me.
She never forgot about Ain El Hilweh, Gabriel said absently. What did she study?
She was an archaeologist.
Gabriel remembered the appearance of her fingernails. He'd had the impression then that she was a potter or someone who worked with her hands outdoors. An archaeologist certainly fit that description. Archaeology, you're certain?
He seemed very clear on that point.
Anything else?
Yeah, Azuri said. 2 years ago, she sent him a very strange letter. She told him to destroy all the letters and photographs she'd sent from Europe over the years. The old man disobeyed his daughter's wishes. The letters and photos were all he had left of her. A couple of weeks later, a bully boy shows up in his room and burned the things for him.
Friend of Khaled, Gabriel thought. Khaled was trying to erase her past. How did you play it with him?
You got the information you wanted. Leave the operational details to me, Mike.
Did you show him the sketch?
I showed him. He wept. He hadn't seen his daughter in 15 years.
An hour later, Gabriel checked out of the hotel and drove to the airport, where he waited until the evening flight to Tel Aviv. It was after midnight by the time he returned to Narcus Street. Kiara was asleep. She stirred as he climbed into bed, but did not wake. When he pressed his lips against her bare shoulder, she murmured incoherently and rolled away from him. He looked at his nightstand. The papers were gone.